In order to track with me tonight, you're going to have to pay close attention, at least in this first segment, because let me tell you, let me give you the game plan of how I'm going to negotiate this thing here. I'm going to start off with some Star Wars talk, right? some pop culture. I'm going to weave it through some Christian theology, and then I'm going to stick the landing in politics. And it's all going to be consistent. It's all going to have this through line. Closing argument. My name is Walter Hudson. Twin Cities News Talk, AM 1130, 103.5 FM, TwinCitiesNewsTalk.com, and your iHeartRadio app. Two ways to stream the program. You can catch us 9 to 11 weeknights. Appreciate you tuning in. You can catch up with the podcasts right there in your iHeartRadio app as well. Just do a search for Closing Argument. Give us a call, 651-989-5855. If you feel so inclined this evening, share your thoughts, concerns, reactions, complaints. We take it all. Brad Omland taking those calls and producing the show. So I'm a big fan of this guy, John Campia, who is a video producer and film commentator. He used to run a blog back in the day called The Movie Blog. And he's just incredibly insightful. He's an example of a self-made guy who, you know, has just got the gumption. It's kind of funny because politically you can tell he's a liberal, but in practice, the way that he has crafted his career and his various business endeavors is a practical manifestation, an exercise in conservatism, an exercise in capitalism. And he knows it, as is evident in his commentary on Hollywood and the way the movie industry works. Anyway, he's got a YouTube channel now called The Movie Vlog, video blog. And on Tuesdays, he has this thing called Star Wars Talk Tuesdays. And this past week, or actually yesterday, he got a question that I thought was really interesting, really provocative. And the question was regarding whether or not it was fair. And again, we're talking about Star Wars here, and I'm sure the vast majority of the audience is familiar with at least the classic trilogy of Star Wars. Whether or not it was fair for Darth Vader to be redeemed at the end of Return of the Jedi by virtue of the fact that he engaged in a single selfless act of saving his son, and whether that countered the balance, whether that balanced with the fact that he was responsible for so many atrocities across the galaxy, you know, previous to that. And it provoked this interesting response from Campia in terms of, you know, trying to actually do the math, right? He's like, well, you gotta keep in mind that, you know, not only did he save Luke, but he also defeated the Emperor, and that ended the war, and there would have been billions of people who would have died otherwise, and yada, 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 yada. What I find interesting about that is that it demonstrates in this pop culture little sphere this tendency that I think is very prevalent amongst all of us, which is to try to engage in this balancing of the scales between good deeds and bad deeds, right? If we... And the aim of our lives is to try to accumulate more good deeds than bad deeds. And if we can achieve that, if we can tilt the scales more on the good side than the bad side, then we can take comfort in the fact that we are, on the whole, quote unquote, good people, right? Now, contrast this idea, this very popular, secular, sentimental idea, with the claims of Christian theology, which offer a very different value proposition. The value proposition that you'll find in your Bible laying on your shelf is that no, even if you've only done a few bad things, you're guilty, right? And you're due the wrath of God. And the only path to redemption is not doing a lot of good things to make up for the bad things that you've done, but rather trusting in the sacrifice of Jesus Christ, who led a perfect life so that you can adopt his righteousness for yourself, right? Now, why do I make this comparison? Because it has a political effect. These ideas have a political manifestation. If you believe that the only way to right wrongs is to counterbalance them with good deeds, then you are going to tend towards the brand of activism which we see most prevalent on the left in the form of, say, Antifa, right? Or Black Lives Matter, or whatever the case may be. The very concept of social justice is this idea that redemption can be found in punishing perceived evildoers and forcing good deeds, good acts, corrective actions in order to tilt the scales back in the direction of justice. It's the mentality that rationalizes the acquittal of O.J. Simpson on the basis that black people have gotten a raw deal in the United States of America going back to chattel slavery and Jim Crow and the innumerable beatings and false imprisonments and denial of basic human dignity throughout American history. Because of all of that, O.J. Simpson properly ought to be innocent, regarded as innocent, for having murdered his wife and his wife's friend. That's the calculus there. So this idea, you know, starting with, that's exemplified in a question to a YouTuber about Star Wars. This idea has very profound implications in terms of how we think about the world we live in and what kinds of policies we advocate for. You know, I really do believe that a prerequisite to a culture that adopts and values and promotes this concept of liberty, because here's the thing about liberty, and it's something that makes a lot of people very uncomfortable. Liberty is not a condition in which every slight against you is answered in kind. Liberty is a condition where you have to turn the other cheek on a regular basis in order to maintain the condition. You know, if somebody says something that offends you or even does something that's within the scope of their rights that you find disgusting, offensive, reprehensible, you don't get to do anything to them at all. You don't get to hit them. You don't get to fine them. You don't get to imprison them. You don't get to initiate force to stop them. You just have to deal with it. A word that comes to mind that kind of evokes this is the word tolerance, right? This is the actual meaning of the word tolerance. Actual tolerance, not the kind that the left promotes, which is not tolerance at all, but actual tolerance requires you to let things roll off your back, right? To let things slide, to be a grown-up. This is the difference, one of the differences between grown-ups and children. Children don't let things slide. Certainly mine don't, right? If either of my boys, 8 and 4 years old, if either of them feel as though they've been slighted in the least way, it is a federal case. It is a federal case, and justice must be served right now. And usually the type of, you know, if they're talking about something that the other one did to them, the type of justice that they're looking for is disproportionate to whatever the crime was, right? He touched me. You know, you should confine him in his room for a month, right? But that bears out in terms when we grow up and in the larger society, that bears out in terms of the types of calls and the types of advocacy that people engage in order to answer perceived slights. You know, going back to the notion of this racial stuff, because we're going to get into a few stories here regarding white privilege. It's going to be an exciting night tonight, white privilege. You're going to find out how privileged you are, folks. In this whole racial conversation, there's this notion that because there have been all these wrongs committed in the past, not even to people who exist today, but just to a class of people, right, that justifies a basically a punishment, right? A corrective action, which must right the scales and balance things and provide social justice. This is a view of the world that evokes the cliche that, you know, an eye for an eye leaves the whole world blind, right? You know, if we go about trying to right every wrong through the force of government, we're all going to be left without liberty. And that's kind of where we find ourselves. By way of example, from the Star Tribune, the University of California, Berkeley will seal off large parts of its campus like a fortress with a closed perimeter and a very large visible police presence Thursday when the birthplace of America's free speech movement faces its next potential clashes. City and campus authorities anticipate demonstrations at a speech by conservative commentator Ben Shapiro, a former Breitbart editor, and are preparing for possible violence with a variety of new strategies and tightened security. For the first time in 2 decades, officers will be armed with pepper spray after the city council modified a 1997 ban at an emergency meeting this week. The tactics to boost security are the latest indication of growing frustrations in Berkeley and other liberal cities that have become targets of violent political protests since the election of President Donald Trump, and battlegrounds for extremist groups that support and oppose him. We have seen extremists on the left and the right in our city, said Berkeley Mayor Jesse R. Gwynn, a Democrat who backed the police request to use pepper spray. We need to make sure violence is not allowed. Now, this is a marked turn in the approach, in the rhetoric and policy from the mayor of Berkeley. This gentleman in the past has been very accommodating to the protesters. He's been all but sided with Antifa against not Nazis, right? But people like Ben Shapiro. A regular old, you know, if you know anything about Ben Shapiro, if you've read what he's written or listened to his podcast or seen him on television, he's certainly provocative, right? He's interesting. He says things that gets people riled up. But on the pantheon of provocateurs, he ranks pretty low. Right? He's a pretty sober, intellectual guy who makes a fairly rational case for the ideas he's advocating for. And in his prep leading up to this event in Berkeley, he's been very clear that he denounces violence, that he will not accept the presence of people, quote, supporting him, unquote, who initiate violence or come with the notion that they're going to confront protesters and try to protect his right to speak. He's been very clear saying that's the cop's job. We've paid a large fee, a security fee, with the expectation that the police will do their job. And part and parcel of what he's attempting to accomplish here is showing the world, showing the nation, whether or not that's actually going to happen. But we find ourselves in this situation where a sober-minded intellectual like Ben Shapiro can't go to a city like Berkeley without fear of being run out of town, without fear of violent riots, to the point where even the lefties in California feel they have to re-enshrine the use of pepper spray in order to defend their leftward shores, right? This is the kind of environment that is enabled when you believe that the scales of social justice must be balanced with the fervor of a 3-year-old who's upset that his brother was touching him. Closing argument. My name is Walter Hudson. Twin Cities News Talk, AM 1130, 103.5 FM, TwinCitiesNewsTalk.com. This concept of white privilege can be rather elusive. Because, you know, it's one of those things that, due to its use in the public discourse, it tends to be one of those polarizing phrases where either you adopt the popular conception of what white privilege means and what it implies and what it demands in terms of a response, or you reject it as total garbage, right? Those are the two options that people tend to find themselves drawn towards. The fact of the matter is, there is a reality that is being drawn upon or acknowledged to some extent by the people who talk about white privilege that we ought to understand and that we need to acknowledge and think about clearly in order to appropriately fight back against those who evoke the concept of white privilege as a rhetorical bludgeon with which to beat us over the head and attempt to deprive us of our liberty. Closing argument. My name is Walter Hudson. Twin Cities News Talk, AM 1130, 103.5 FM, 651-989-5855, the number to join us this evening. From USA Today, ESPN has sent out a statement regarding tweets from SportsCenter anchor, you're going to have to help me with this one. Is it Jamel?
Jamel Hill.
Jamel Hill. that were sent out Monday saying her views didn't reflect those of the network. Hill went on a tirade about President Donald Trump, in which he called him a white supremacist and said he was unfit to be president. And it goes on to cite a number of her tweets, one of which was, "The height of white privilege is being able to ignore Trump's white supremacy because it's no threat to you." Well, it's a threat to me, she said. So there you go. White privilege. You're supposed to be very much aware of this, which leads me to a commentary by a stand-up comedian by the name of Omar Ishmael. And this was on a site called Quora.com. My wife sent this to me. She's doing a little production on the site now, radio production, which is kind of nice. So somebody sent this stand-up comedian a question, and the question was, "I am white. That's all you need to know about me. I am privileged based on that alone and assuming I am. Should I feel guilt? And what should I do about it?" That was the question. Which, can we just pause to appreciate how absurd it is that somebody feels they have to ask this question? How guilty should I feel? And how should I respond to that guilt?
Yeah, it's immediately like every time that you get into an argument with someone online and they bring up white privilege, it's like you should feel guilty for who you are.
Right. Yeah, that's exactly what it is. Now, this guy tries to pretend as though that's not what it is that they're going for. And it's really interesting how he goes about arguing. This is his answer to the question of should this person, this white person, feel guilt and what should they do about it? Omar says, "Absolutely. Consider it this way. All I know about you is you're tall. Do you have any advantages? Yes. Does that mean you don't deserve the can of tuna on the higher shelf? No, nobody is saying that. Eat away, mighty giant. Should you feel guilty about getting the tuna from the top shelf? No, nobody is saying that. Lighten your soul's burden and let it fly free in the clouds beneath your knees. Does that mean short people can't get the tuna? No, nobody is saying that. See how the enduring hobbit pushes forward in her quest," and it has a picture of a short girl climbing the shelves at a grocery store. "Does that mean there aren't advantages of being tall? No, nobody is saying that. You have our sympathy for your poor bruised knees when you find yourself in an airplane where the person in front of you leans back in their seat. What people are saying is, one, denying you are lucky is silly. Two, stop looking bewildered every time a short person can't reach something. We're sick of explaining this incredibly simple concept. Three, we know there are things you do not have, i.e. even higher shelves. Four, we know there may be other things preventing you reaching the high shelves. Maybe you have bad elbows or arthritis. Short people with arthritis are still below you. You are still lucky you are tall. Five, it works out well for most people for the grocery store to put most things on medium shelves. Six, if you can help shorter people with things on higher shelves, do so. Why would you not do that? Short people can help you with stuff on lower shelves." And it goes on in this fashion. Now, there's an interesting thing that's taken place here, and that it is manifest throughout the entire culture that's promoting white privilege as something that we all need to be aware of. And it's interesting. He closes this out here saying, "White privilege means you have an advantage, and all anyone is asking is that you get that. Once you get that, it's pretty straightforward to all the further implications." Now, is it though? Like, what are the implications of it? Like, let's go with his analogy about tall people. What is implied by the recognition of the advantages, quote unquote, that I have for being tall? What implication does that make? What does that obligate me to? Why do I have to spend any time at all contemplating the burden of short people? What does that do for them? What does that do for me? Of what value is it whatsoever? You know, I used to work in a previous career. For the vast majority of my adult life, I used to work overnights and sleep during the day. Now, as anybody who's worked the late shift can tell you, nobody cares that you work the late shift. Nobody cares that you need to sleep during the day. None of your relatives who have birthday parties at 1 o'clock in the afternoon, you know, or your church group that has an event in the middle of the morning and expects you to be there. Nobody cares that you were up all night working. They don't understand. They don't get it, right? They think you ought to be able to just shake it off, right? You know, now if you showed up at 3 o'clock in the morning at their house and woke them up and said, "Hey, let's go party," they'd be flaming mad. But they do it to you all the time because the sun's out, right? Anybody who's worked the late shift can relate to this. So what? Like, it's annoying, but do we need to have a class action lawsuit on behalf of people who work overnights to demand the rights of the late shift? You know, you can't do construction until 1 p.m. to make sure that there's some period of time during which I can sleep without hearing a jackhammer, you know? Or do we just have to deal with it? Because that's the way.
Get $20 off your plan when you visit grasshopper.com/radio. grasshopper.com/radio.
You're listening to Closing Argument with Walter Hudson.
Tomorrow morning, Sam's Top 5 at 620, plus Katie Pavlich from Fox News joins us at 835.
Justice and Drew, 6 to 9 on Twin Cities News Talk, AM 1130 and 103.5 FM.
Breaking news this evening. Democrats say they have a deal with Trump on protecting young immigrants from deportation. We're going to read through the details here at the top of the hour, and we'll come back to it on the other side of that break. To kind of set it up here, I have a little bit more pop culture stuff to reference. Closing argument, my name is Walter Hudson, Twin Cities News Talk, AM 1130, 103.5 FM. From the Hollywood Reporter, Superman protects undocumented workers from armed white supremacist in latest comic. The moment in the book released Wednesday comes a week after President Trump ended DACA. Perhaps it's just a coincidence, but perhaps not. In the recent issue of Action Comics number 987, entitled The Oz Effect, released Wednesday, Superman arrives in the nick of time to protect a group of undocumented immigrants from a white man sporting an American flag bandana, wielding a machine gun, who is going to shoot them for taking his job. Superman blocks the bullets before they hit the terrified people. "Stop this," Superman orders the gunman. "Why?" he responds. "They ruined me, stole from me." Grabbing the gunman by the collar and pulling him in close, Superman says, "The only person responsible for the blackness smothering your soul is you." Police arrive and Superman hands over the gunman and tells officers to make sure the victims are safe and cared for. An officer responds, "Anything you say, Superman." The moment comes just 1 week after President Donald Trump made the controversial announcement that he was ending the Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals policy put in place by former President Barack Obama. Now, there are a couple of reactions that I have to this. First of all, just historically, just to speak to the character and to speak to the history of Superman as a comic book and as a character, this is actually pretty consistent, whether you like it or not, with the progressive, quote-unquote, roots of the character. Superman in the original, when he was first created, the original comics back in the late 1930s, early 1940s, was primarily a social justice warrior of his time. Like, he was going around, you know, beating on landlords for hassling their tenants and whatnot, and kicking people out of their tenant buildings and what have you. Like, there weren't super villains back in the day. He was engaged in social issues. That was his whole deal, you know, that and stopping criminals. And so this is actually pretty consistent with the character. So unlike a lot of things which have happened over the years where, you know, you have turning Thor into a woman or I don't know, Captain America becomes gay or whatever the case may be. I don't think that one's happened yet, but something similar to that effect. This is not a leftist twisting of the character in order to fit with a modern agenda. It's actually pretty consistent. But the other thing to note here is that what actually happens in this comic book and Superman's response to what actually happens is not particularly controversial, right? Like, who's for murdering illegal aliens, right? Like, I point that out to me. Who's the person who's advocating for a public policy whereby we just step aside and allow dudes in American flag bandanas with machine guns to riddle immigrants with bullets, right? I think it's pretty non-controversial to say that we're all generally universally against that, right? So it's not as though this is a demonstration of some sort of grand point that's being made in this comic book. But it does demonstrate how the left thinks of those of us, of you, who want to tighten immigration law. It's interesting in this Hollywood Reporter article that they, right next to each other, they attach the depiction of a guy in a comic book, a white guy in a comic book who wants to gun down a bunch of Mexicans, illegal immigrants, that they put that right next to the mention of President Donald Trump making the controversial announcement that he was ending the Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals policy. That's an equivocation. That is basically suggesting that it is equal to say we're going to enforce immigration law against the children of illegals, that is equal to gunning down a bunch of illegal immigrants, right? One and the same. Well, no, they're not. They're not at all. And again, you know, this is an example, you know, just like we've been talking about with white privilege throughout this.
Talk. AM 1130. Right now it's 73.
iHeartRadio is the easy-to-use app for music and radio. Download the free iHeartRadio app today.
I've said on the program before, and I've meant it, that I would much rather live in the world where I am wrong about Donald Trump than the world where I get to say, I told you so. You know, I'm not going to lie, there's a cathartic release in I told you so, right? Like when you call something and it pans out the way you called it, you know, there's a certain amount of pride involved in witnessing that and acknowledging it. But the value of that, whatever value there is to that, is insignificant to the point of nominal in comparison to the value I would attain if I was wrong about Donald Trump. I really wish I was. Unfortunately, he's demonstrating time and time again, day after day, in a way that really is actually kind of shocking to me. I mean, he's just brazen about it now in terms of the way that he's just demonstrating that he never at any point had any sort of intention to fulfill the promises that he campaigned on, to be a conservative, to look out for the Republican Party, whose loyalty he demanded and his supporters demanded, right? And continues to demand, right? Like, at this point in our history as a party, there is an ongoing demand, and in fact, it's probably going to manifest next year in primaries and caucuses and what have you, that people basically swear fealty to Trump. Like, that's going to be a standard that is applied to some extent or another. Where are you with Trump? Are you for him or are you against him? Not are you for the policy he's for, right? Not do you support the tactic that he's employing, but are you for or against him as a person? Are you personally loyal to him? That's the standard that's being employed right now, right? And the question that I have for the people who are offering that standard is why? What are you getting out of the deal? I don't understand it. Increasingly, each and every day, the answer seems to be precisely nothing. Closing argument. My name is Walter Hudson, Twin Cities News Talk, AM 1130, 103.5 FM, TwinCitiesNewsTalk.com, and your iHeartRadio app. Two ways to stream the program. We're here 9 to 11 weeknights. Appreciate you tuning in. 651-989-5855 to explain to me why, what hope you are holding out that something good is going to come of this president and this administration from a conservative, Republican, law and order, rule of law perspective. From the Pioneer Press, The top House and Senate Democrats said Wednesday they had reached agreement with President Donald Trump to protect thousands of younger immigrants from deportation and fund some border security enhancements, not including Trump's long-sought border wall. The deal announced by Senate Democrat leader Chuck Schumer and House Democrat leader Nancy Pelosi following a White House dinner would enshrine protections for nearly 800,000 immigrants brought illegally to this country as kids who had benefited from former President Barack Obama's Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals, or DECA, program. The program provided temporary work permits and protection from deportation. Trump ended the program earlier this month and had given Congress 6 months to come up with a legislative fix before the statuses of the so-called Dreamers begin to expire. We agreed to enshrine the protections of DACA into law quickly and to work out a package of border security, excluding the wall, that's acceptable to both sides, Pelosi and Schumer said in a joint statement. This is the real world in which you live. You live in a world where I'm sorry for my confusion. You can understand it at this point. Where Donald Trump cuts deals when he has a majority, right? In the Senate, a majority in Congress is cutting deals with Nancy Pelosi and Chuck Schumer to enshrine DECA into law. I want to see Ann Coulter's face right now. I want to see Steve Bannon's face right now. These people, Ann Coulter, who wrote a book entitled In Trump We Trust, the premise of which was, this is the guy who's going to do what we've been calling for on immigration for years. And he sure campaigned like it, didn't he? Now, listen, I don't agree with the hard line immigration stance that Trump took during the campaign last year. Like, my sense of what immigration law ought to be isn't even represented in the debate on immigration. I have a much more nuanced position regarding how we ought to craft the laws which govern who can come here and under what circumstances. But be that as it may, it doesn't even matter what your position is on immigration, unless you were one of the people who wanted to see the hard line taken on DACA, the hard line taken on illegal immigrants, the deportation as a threat to the children of people who are brought here illegally. If you wanted to see that, Donald Trump told you he was going to do it. I mean, he's on tape saying they're going to have to leave. They're going to have to get out of here. You know, maybe they can come back. Maybe, I don't know, but they're going to have to go. We're a nation of laws, right? You guys remember this? It was just mere months ago. It wasn't even full a year ago. Now he's cutting a deal with Nancy Pelosi. Like, take yourself back to, I don't know, September, a full year, September of 2016. If Donald Trump had gotten up in front of a campaign rally and said, here's what we're going to do. I can't do a Trump impersonation, sorry. Here's what we're going to do. You elect me. I'm going to get in the White House. I'm going to wait a few months. And then I'm going to put my arms around my good friend Nancy Pelosi and my other good friend Chuck Schumer. And together, we are going to enshrine into law the executive amnesty that was forwarded by current President Barack Obama. Are you with me? Would you have stood up and cheered? I'm just curious. Would you have? Because that's what he's doing. Right? I don't know what you're holding out for at this point. The people who have just been on the Trump train nonstop, no matter what he says or does, the last thing that made any sort of rational sense to me, even though I vehemently disagree with it, the last thing that made any sort of sense to me was this idea that, look, if he at least does something on trade and immigration, right? If he builds the wall. The wall is almost like the physical manifestation of the last holdout for hope for a lot of Trump supporters. As long as he builds the wall, I don't care what else he does. Build the wall. He just made a deal to not build it, right? To get what? I don't know. Like, what is he getting out of this deal? What are Republicans getting out of this deal? Nothing. Nothing. You know, it's amazing. in the media, you'll see a lot of people talking about, like, trying to toot the horn of Democrats, trying to act like Nancy Pelosi and Chuck Schumer are somehow noble statesmen because they've managed to reach across the aisle and work with Donald Trump on these issues. They're not statesmen. There's no, this is, to call it a deal is a euphemism. This is a surrender, right? This is just a cave. That's all it is. You know, if, imagine the reverse. If Chuck Schumer and Nancy Pelosi walked in the room and said, Mr. President, we're going to build your wall. We're going to kick out all the illegals. We're going to deport them, right? We're going to fully fund the military to whatever. You just give you a blank check. Whatever number you want, we're going to fill in the blank. And Trump just said, okay, yeah, sure, let's do all that. Would that have been a major deal-making on Trump's part? Right? Would he get some sort of credit for reaching across the aisle to accept precisely what he campaigned on? No. And yet the Democrats are trying to take credit, you know, and the media is trying to give the Democrats credit as though they're somehow, you know, noble statesmen who've yielded something here. All they're doing is receiving what they want. And by the way, what Donald Trump wanted as well. You know, I did a quick Google search. Trump on immigration. Here's some of the results that came up. From the Daily Caller, Trump always backed immigration reform. That's true. From Huffington Post, Trump is changing the immigration debate. From the Chicago Tribune, Schumer, Pelosi announced deal with Trump to save Dreamers. This is like an alternative reality. This is like an episode of The Twilight Zone. Do not adjust your sets, folks. I would really like to, you know, it's strangely, the phones are silent. It's kind of weird.
One lady can call to complain that you were saying bad things about Trump.
Oh, well, by all means.
But we're a Republican station, so we can't say bad things about Trump, you know.
Listen, I will step aside and yield the floor to the person or persons who wants to defend this. I won't even I'll give you a, you know, a solid, I mean, you know, our segments are, you know, 10 minutes or so. I'll give you two uninterrupted minutes, so long as you can, you know, fill them. I'm not gonna have dead air, right? But two uninterrupted minutes to tell me why this is a good thing and how this is a fulfillment of anything that Trump promised whatsoever.
I mean, politically, like, just in terms of good policy, like, it's good policy to extend DACA, but the way Trump did it, wrong. Kicking it to Congress, I think, was the right move because that's where Obama failed. But working with Democrats to accomplish something for the Republican Party, it goes back to the argument that we had last week with the caller who said, like, is Trump the leader of the, is he the president or is he the leader of the Republican Party? And he has to be both. He has to be both. Historically, it's not separated. And so if he's not going to support Republicans in what he does as president, even if it might be the right move in terms of good policy, like, he's just not doing anybody favors.
Well, that's just it, is that he's clearly not motivated by any sort of conviction regarding what the policy actually ought to be, right? He's certainly not motivated by the political promises he made on the campaign trail. He's also not motivated by the electoral aspirations of the party which claims him, which he is the standard bearer of, right? It's very unclear what motivation he has at all, other than perhaps, and this has been floated by Ben Shapiro, and I think with some credibility, good press. Good press. After months and months of taking a beating from the press every single day, the things Trump has said, the backtracking, the backsliding, if you will, on immigration has earned him praise in the media and Trump alike. He likes getting praise.
Starting at 6:20.
We've got an update on the ongoing dispute between Dayton and the legislature. That'll happen in the 7 o'clock hour.
And Katie Pavlich from Fox News joins us at 8:35.
Justice and Drew, 6 to 9, Twin Cities News Talk, AM 1130 and 103.5 FM.
Mm. one of the favorite tactics of the left in order to advance their agenda, advance their worldview, is to conflate things. And the way this tactic works best is to conflate things that are true with things that are false, or to conflate things that are not alike at all, but one of them indicates something that you know to be true, and so you kind of borrow, you kind of afford the truth from the one thing to the other. It's called a package deal. That's what Ayn Rand used to refer to this trick of rhetoric as, where you have to accept the whole thing, and you end up swallowing a lie with your dose of truth. Closing argument. My name is Walter Hudson, Twin Cities News Talk, AM 1130, 103.5 FM, TwinCitiesNewsTalk.com, and your iHeartRadio app. Two ways to stream us, 9 to 11 weeknights. Appreciate you tuning in. 651-989-5855, the number to join us. Brad Ullman taking those calls. When we talk about white privilege, or when the left talks about white privilege, they are engaged in conflation. You know, because there are certain things that they're referencing when they talk about white privilege that are in fact correct, right? There may in fact be ways in which white people are treated differently in certain contexts than non-white people, right? There may in fact be a different experience that I have had as someone of mixed race than a black person has had. A full black person or a full white person, right? Like, my experience is unique. Every single individual person has had a unique experience given the confluence of their different identifying factors. And so, to varying degrees, you could say we each enjoy different privileges, some greater than others, right? That's true. That's true. There's no denying that. But here's the problem. The left wants to conflate the rational with the irrational. They want to conflate the objective with the subjective. You know, this analogy utilized by stand-up comedian Omar Ishmael between race and height, right? He talks about tall privilege, the privilege of tall people being able to grasp at things on higher shelves and whatnot, and how tall people should be aware of the fact that they have this privilege and mindful of it, and that there are implications of that in terms of how they treat short people and interact with short people. That's the analogy that he utilizes in order to try to convey something profound about quote-unquote white privilege. What he's conflating there is, you know, the objective difference in height, of course, has implications for how you can interact with the physical world, right? Of course it does. And in a similar sense, you could argue that there are characteristics, like, for instance, the fact that I have African heritage has a real effect upon certain health factors in my life, right? Like, I have to be more concerned about diabetes. I have to be more concerned about heart disease because statistically, heredity plays a factor in those things, right? That's an objective fact. That's rational. That's objective. What's not objective, what's not rational, is to assume that certain things will happen, or that I have certain unrelated characteristics that are going to manifest simply because I'm black, right? To assume that somebody's less intelligent, to assume that somebody's less capable because of a factor which is not determinative, a factor which is not objective, that doesn't interact in a certain way in the real world. And that's a distinction that the left does not want to make. Because if you, and we saw this in terms of their treatment of Charles Murray over writing a book called The Bell Curve, in which he spoke to the statistical fact of what intelligence tests on the aggregate have to say about differences in class, including class defined by race, right? He must be a racist because he's actually citing objective, demonstrable statistics. No. It depends upon what conclusions you're drawing as a result of that which you're observing. That's what determines whether or not you're engaged in some sort of bias, some sort of bigotry, some sort of racism. There's also a failure, a conflation between, and I think this is the most important one, a conflation between social privilege, if you want to call it that, and political privilege. My children enjoy a social privilege in the context of their family, right? Like they're the grandkids of the family, right? Them and their cousins. So they get that grandkid privilege. They get the child privilege. My four-year-old gets the baby privilege. He's the baby amongst the cousins, right? My eldest is the firstborn of the grandchildren. He has the firstborn privilege, right?
Okay, since we're talking about this, like, and I recommended this like when we first started the show, everybody needs to read the short story, Harrison Bergeron, by Kurt Vonnegut. It's a story about how everyone is literally equal. Like, if you're too smart and you can think too well, like, you get a noise in your ear. If you're too strong, you have to carry bags. And, like, it takes 5 to 10 minutes to read.
Right.
Like, you will not be disappointed by the absurdity of it.
Yeah, I forget the who to attribute it to, but somebody made the, at some point somebody talked about, oh, it was Craig Westover, an activist here in Minnesota who now lives on a boat down around Florida, in point of fact, talked about how, you know, if you wanted to equalize yourself with LeBron James, you know, you hobble LeBron James. You cut him off at the knees, right? And now you're equal. That's the kind of thing that you're talking about.
Or there was even a Goosebumps book I remember called Be Careful What You Wish For, and this girl wished she was the best player on the basketball team, so every other player got sick.
Right, right, yeah, right. That's great. That's fantastic. So, I mean, the reason I bring this up is that there are certain privileges that manifest as a result of either your physical characteristics or your social status with other people, right? Like, my son is my son to me. My kids are my kids to me, and they enjoy certain privileges in our home and amongst our family because of the status they hold, the relationships that they have, right? And that is true of every other human being within the context of their family, their community, wherever they happen to be. And some people's aggregate of privileges may put them at an advantage over others to some degree or another. The question becomes, so what? So what? To what are you entitled because the dice, you rolled a 1 and somebody else rolled a 6, right? What do they owe you on account of that? Now, that's the social privilege. The other side of the equation, which the left likes to conflate, but they don't like to focus on, is political privilege. Political privilege. And this is what they actually advocate for, right? They want to give people, through the force of law, privileges that are attached to their status. Affirmative action, right? Title IX, you know, call it what you will. Cite whatever example you like. The idea that you ought to be, under the force of law, you ought to command a privilege that is not granted you through social status, but is rather enforced at the point of a gun. Let me give you an example of this from elsewhere in the world. This is something that the left does not care about at all. Every Sunday at my church, we spend a little bit of time in prayer talking about the persecuted church. And, you know, we pull a couple of examples of countries around the globe, and we spend some time reflecting upon the persecution that our brothers and sisters in the Christian community have to endure in those places. Here's an example. The nation of Bhutan. Bhutan is stuck between, this is quoting from opendoorsusa.org. Bhutan is stuck between two giant neighbors, India to its south and China to its north. It does not appear often in international headlines, but gained some fame for its invention of the gross national happiness product in order to measure its citizens' overall well-being. Politically, not much has changed in Bhutan as of late, where democracy seems to be establishing firmer roots, albeit in a climate in which all parties agree with the dominance of Buddhism, and the king is cherished. The situation of Christians has remained stable, which means that they continue to lack any formal status or recognition and are persecuted for not adhering to the Buddhist national heritage. Open Doors provides immediate aid to Bhutanese believers when their faith in Christ lands them in prison, excludes them from families and communities, and deprives them of livelihood and employment. It goes on to talk about the outreach that they engage in here. Now, I raise this to demonstrate two points. One, is anybody concerned about Buddhist privilege in Bhutan? Is anybody concerned about the ethnic privilege that the Bhutanese enjoy over any white people who happen to live there? Right? Is this something that we need to do something about? But also note, even here, there's a difference when we talk about persecution of a religion. There's a difference between the social persecution of my family doesn't like me because I converted to Christianity, or I can't get a job because nobody wants to hire a Christian in Bhutan. There's a difference between those things and I'm going to prison because of what I believe. A difference between social privilege and political privilege, one of which properly in the condition of liberty, we have no right to do anything about, at least with force. And the other of which we ought to be concerned with. And because the left conflates all of this, because the left wraps it all up in one giant package deal, it prevents us from effectively combating the political privileges which are inappropriate, right? It prevents us from combating those things which are violations of rights because people throw out the baby with the bathwater. They say,
/free for your free trial. ZipRecruiter.com/free.
You're listening to Closing Argument with Walter Hudson.
Tomorrow morning, Sam's Top 5 at 620, plus Katie Pavlich from Fox News joins us at 8:35.
Justice and Drew, 6 to 9 on Twin Cities News Talk, AM 1130 and 103.5 FM.
For the second time in a week, President Donald Trump has cut a deal with the Democratic minority in Congress in order to do something that Republicans generally oppose. And, in this case, something that he explicitly campaigned against. The headline at the Pioneer Press, Democrats say they have a deal with Trump on protecting young immigrants from deportation. They're going to enshrine DACA. In exchange, they're going to, you know, do a few security improvements, security enhancements, not including the wall. No wall, folks. No wall. And a legislative enshrinement of DACA. How's this working out for you? How's that ride on the Trump train feeling right about now? Closing argument. My name is Walter Hudson, Twin Cities News Talk, AM 1130, 103.5 FM, 651-989-5855 if you care to comment. Let's go to Terry and Blaine. Thanks for holding. Welcome to the show.
Oh, yeah, first off, I voted for Trump. I believe he has tried to work with Republicans. Here's the thing. I don't think a conservative Republican will be voted into office again. I believe if the Republican Party has to institute superdelegates or some nonsense like the Democrats used to get Hillary as their nominee, they'll do it. I think there's almost no difference between the two parties except things to distract people like the moral issues like abortion, which they're never going to overturn. We are going to have amnesty, and we probably will have universal health care, and that is not coming from the government. It's coming from the people that actually run the government, in my opinion.
So how are you feeling as somebody who voted for Trump about this particular decision and this particular deal?
Disappointed. Like I said, it's about what I expected. I think we could come back 25 years from now and there'll be no meaningful progress towards any of the things that we'd like to see.
Then why did you even vote for Trump?
I'm a fatalist, but I see no evidence that'll be any different than that. And I haven't seen anything since Reagan and Clinton scavenging off of Reagan's progress that was anything that made me happy as far as how the federal government runs.
So let me just make sure I'm understanding this correctly. You expected when you cast your vote for Donald Trump that a few months into his presidency, he was going to cut a deal with the Democratic Party minority in Congress.
I didn't expect it. I was hoping that wouldn't be the case, but it always goes to the center, no matter what.
Oh, okay. I gotcha.
Or so, actually, the gutter, like if you're a bowler with a 35 average score, it always ends up in the gutter.
Or as long as we're coming up with analogies, a swamp, right? Like it sounds like a swamp is pretty well in place here. Appreciate your call.
That's what it is, and I don't see how it'll ever be changed.
Yeah.
I think once to get into a position to be a congressman or the president, you sold your soul many times over. You're probably a narcissist. most likely a sociopath. Like,
well, now you're speaking my language.
You see what I'm saying?
Yeah. Right? No. I definitely am with you on that cynicism. I don't think it's. I don't want to be fatalistic about it. I don't think we're doomed
to
it
either. But I don't see anything that makes me want to be optimistic at this point.
I hear you. I appreciate the call, Terry. Yeah, I'm struggling though coming out of that conversation to understand how I'm supposed to think about Donald Trump. Maybe Dee can help us out in Eden Prairie. Welcome to the program.
Hey, guys. Hey. I just informed my friend, and she's a DACA child. Well, she's actually 31 right now. And they've been here. They've been working on their papers.
Right.
The cost factor. And they're good citizens. And I'm very happy that this is working out. It still has to go through Congress, doesn't it, to get a final deal?
Right.
So we'll see what happens with the idiots in Congress. Because they haven't passed anything.
Right.
That Trump has wanted to work on.
You're right. And isn't it going to be amazing when the first major legislative accomplishment they have is something that President Donald Trump campaigned against?
Well, you know what? At this point in time, and looking at all the polling on the DACA people, something
sure
needs to be done about it. I'm so disgusted. They've had since my first time I ever voted, Reagan. And they've had all these years to do something about it. So if you really want to attack anybody, you should all be attacking the Chamber of Commerce, because they have a huge lobby, and they are the ones that have been stopping any passing, because the last caller was right. You've got to be a narcissist. You've got to be you're always bought. Look at our own Jason Lewis, which I helped campaign for. He has voted on a couple of things that I haven't liked.
Uh-huh.
Eventually, your soul does get you get. Something happens to them when you get elected. Something happens to their, they get power.
But I thought, and I don't know where you stood on Trump, but I thought that's what Trump was elected to change, right? Like, isn't that what Drain the Swamp meant?
Well, guess what? Maybe there's a method to his madness, as I had an aunt say out to me all the time. His 4-year term is just starting. We don't know what's going to happen between now and the end of the fourth. Hell, North Korea could attack us. Who knows? You know, we don't know what's going to happen, what's going to come from it. Might be for the better. It might be worse.
Yeah.
Who knows?
I appreciate your call, Dee.
Worse than what we had with Obama.
Yeah, well.
I voted for Trump primarily because of the U.S. Supreme Court. I did not want it all to go far left.
Yeah, no, I hear you. Well, it's a good thing that because clearly this is some right wing stuff that's happening.
What he does on tax reform.
Yes.
See what happens with that.
Well, he's probably going to raise them, right? Like, I mean, he's probably just going to, you know, he's probably just going to cut a deal with Democrats to do whatever they want, because that's the pattern that he's setting at this point.
Well, you know what? Both parties, you've got to understand this right now. And I listen to a lot of young people. Both parties are finished. The establishment crowd are done. They don't realize it yet. But they're done.
Look,
the drums are beating, and a lot of young people I know, like my son's 22, they're getting PO'd, and they think it's time for revolution.
I hear you, Dee.
Down the road.
I hear you, Dee. I got to tell you, that when you think about the establishment in a bipartisan sense, you don't get any more establishment than Chuck Schumer and Nancy Pelosi, and they're walking tall right now. You should see the photos. Go check out the newspaper. Go Google, right? The photos from today of these two walking out of these negotiations, they are conquering heroes, conquering warriors who have gotten somehow from the perch of
you decide.
Thursday morning, Justice and Drew.
All the stories floating Sam's boat starting at 6:20.
We've got an update on the ongoing dispute between Dayton and the legislature. That'll happen in the 7 o'clock hour.
And Katie Pavlich from Fox News joins us at 8:35.
Justice and Drew, 6 to 9, Twin Cities News Talk, AM 1130 and 103.5 FM.
Taking your live and local reaction to the late breaking news that President Donald Trump after campaigning vigorously on a hardline immigration enforcement stance, has cut a deal with Chuck Schumer and Nancy Pelosi to enshrine DACA into federal law. What? What is happening? What world are we living in? What is happening? I don't understand. And the thing about it that I understand the least is how people are not rioting, how his supporters are not throwing things, just taking to the streets in outrage over the betrayal that this should be perceived as, if you actually care about all that hardline immigration stuff that he campaigned on and that you were jumping on your feet, you know, shouting and rallying and crying about during his campaign.
I don't understand how Trump gets funding for his border wall at this point.
What?
Because
he doesn't.
He's just made every Republican in Congress mad.
Right.
Like, there's no way
they're never going to do it.
Yeah.
I mean, it's... And look, the only, and I pointed it out before, and I have to give credit where credit is due to Ben Shapiro on this. The only interpretation that makes any sense is that his sole motivation for doing these sorts of things, making these two deals that he's made over the past week with Democrats, is to get the favorable press. He reacts to the press. He reacts in a combative fashion, and he also likes to double down on things that he gets praised for. And if it's that, and I have no trouble believing it's that petty. Closing argument. My name is Walter Hudson. Twin Cities News Talk, AM 1130, 103.5 FM. TwinCitiesNewsTalk.com and your iHeartRadio app. Two ways to stream the program. We are here 9 to 11 weeknights. Join us in wonder and awe. Catch up with the podcasts right there in your iHeartRadio app. Just do a search for Closing Argument. 651-989-5855 for your reaction to these late-breaking events. Let's go to Stephen Faribault. He's been holding for some time. Thank you, and welcome to the program.
Hi, Walter. Yeah, I have to agree with what you just said about him. He's looking for the pat on the back. You know, he's been fighting, you know, the last couple of weeks or last month or so about the riots they had in, where was it, where they had the demonstrations and,
right,
and all that. So... you know, so I agree with you on that. I was just thinking here last couple weeks, and especially tonight when you're talking, I look back and I swear I remember him saying he was going to run as a third party candidate if he wasn't nominated by the Republicans.
People forget that. Yep,
yeah,
absolutely.
So, I mean, right there, that kind of tells you, well, he's out for himself.
Yep.
You know, he didn't want the Republican label. If, you know, he kind of did, but he didn't care if he got it or not. He was going to run no matter what.
He wanted it if he could get it. But he didn't care whether or not he had it.
Right. You know, and, you know, if he, you know, and he knew if he didn't get it that the Republicans weren't going to win, you know, because, you know, he had the upper hand there the whole time. Yeah. So, I'm totally not surprised by the moves he's made.
I appreciate your call, Steve. And the thing that I find so perplexing about that, because Steve is 100% right. You know, we have to remember, first of all, the dude was a Democrat, all right? And we seem to have forgotten that entirely. Like, this is consistent with where he's been historically. You know, he only took on the character of Donald Trump, 2016 presidential candidate Donald Trump. That was a character that he took on for the specific purpose of running that campaign. He's a showman. You know, you may have noticed, right? You may have noticed he had this show called The Apprentice, right? That he's a real estate mogul, that he has this brand, that he's a businessman, that he's engaged in advertising and brand development. That's his thing. Something you might have noticed about him. So it should come as no surprise that the character you saw on your television and applauded at rallies in 2016 was just that, a character, not a representation of who he actually is and what he actually believes. This, what he's doing now, is a pretty strong representation of where he's been in the past. So it shouldn't really come as any surprise. What does come as a surprise to me is the phenomenon which took place last year, wherein, in the name of party unity and fidelity to the Republican Party, people like yours truly were told, you better get on board the Trump train, otherwise you're going to be excluded from the community, right? You're going to be excommunicated from the Republican Party for betraying us, for not supporting our nominee. Well, what is that nominee, now that he's president of the United States, what has he done to advance Republicanism and the Republican brand since?
Well, we're the ones living to fight another day, because we're not going to get the ones that are going to be vote, or we're not going to be the ones who are going to be voted out of Congress.
True enough. Let's go to Corey in Bloomington. Welcome to the program. Corey, what's up?
How's it going?
Yeah, it's fantastic.
Yeah. Well, I think he's doing the whole Democrat thing, but I think he's doing it to get, I don't know why he's doing it, to be honest.
Well, I'm right there with you. I mean, I have a sense, but my sense is so depressing, frankly, that I'm trying to grasp for something else, which is something, by the way, that I've noticed. I appreciate your call, Corey. Something that I've noticed a lot of people doing in response to Trump, like the obvious explanation for why he says something or why he does something, you know, the plain answer, which implies something horrendous or something inappropriate, is dismissed because you don't want to believe that that's actually what's motivating him. And so people try to come up with theories as to, well, maybe there's some grand strategy here, or maybe what he really meant was convoluted conspiracy. Yeah. Maybe we should just take the guy at his word, right? Maybe we should just call it like we see it, accept the most obvious, simple explanation for his pattern of behavior and rhetoric. That might lead us on the most predictable path, at least. We won't be so surprised if we actually just pay attention to what he says and predict that he will act accordingly. All right. So I want to turn here to what's going on with climate change right now. It's interesting. You know, speaking of, we had one of our callers just now evoke Charlottesville. And a lot of my friends on the left, a lot of people you know on your social media feed, continue to be outraged over the rise of the Nazis amongst us, right? Because some dudes with tiki torches and a lot of time on their hands decided to get together and say racist stuff at a park in South Carolina, right? Like that's a major threat to society. Meanwhile, there is a stroke of actual fascism that's rising in our culture. Actual fascism. And it's taking place under the guise of advocacy for climate change. From National Review, call it climate McCarthyism. The question, do you believe in climate change, is the new, are you now or have you ever been a member of the Communist Party? Since Donald Trump's election, climate activists, Democratic politicians, and the media have led a collective inquisition into administration officials, creating a blacklist of those who stray from the ideological groupthink on human-caused climate change. These demagogues aim to make climate denial an offense that should prevent anyone from getting a job.